Nehemiah chapter 9, beginning at verse 24. Let's continue reading the great prayer of Nehemiah 9. Here we see, beginning at verse 24, the further tracing of Israel's history from the time of the conquest when they entered the land of Canaan right down to the time of Nehemiah at the end of the chapter. Remember that this prayer is the longest prayer recorded in the Bible, and it's part of the revival that's taking place in Jerusalem after the wall has been rebuilt. The wall had been destroyed by the Babylonians when they took the Jews into captivity in the 6th century BC. Nehemiah, who led the people in the rebuilding project, is present here, but he's not doing the praying. It's the people that are praying. It's not Nehemiah's prayer. It's the prayer of the people. Some believe that Ezra the scribe, that we read about in the book of Ezra, as well as here in Nehemiah, some believe that he wrote the prayer. Well, we don't know for sure, but in any case, whether Ezra the priest and scribe wrote it or someone else wrote it, we see from verse 5 that several Levites are leading the people in this great prayer. We've seen that most of the prayer is a tracing of Israel's history, but it's a tracing of Israel's history from the perspective of how God continually cared for Israel even when they were unfaithful and even when he had to crack the whip, that is, discipline them. So let's take the rest of the prayer now in two sections, and with each section we'll give a background note, a doctrinal point, and practical application. In verses 24 through 31, we follow Israel's history from the conquest through the time of the judges and right down into the time of the kings and prophets. Nehemiah 9, verse 24. So the people went in and possessed the land. You subdued before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and gave them into their hands with their king and the people of the land, that they might do with them as they would. And they took strong cities and a rich land, and possessed houses full of all goods, cisterns already dug, vineyards, olive groves, and fruit trees in abundance. So they ate and were filled and grew fat, and delighted themselves in your great goodness. Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against you, cast your law behind their backs, and killed your prophets who testified against them, to turn them to yourself. And they worked great provocations. Therefore you delivered them into the hand of their enemies, who oppressed them. And in the time of their trouble, when they cried to you, you heard from heaven. And according to your abundant mercies, you gave them deliverers who saved them from the hand of their enemies. But after they had rest, they again did evil before you. Therefore you left them in the hand of their enemies, so that they had dominion over them. Yet when they returned and cried out to you, you heard from heaven, and many times you delivered them according to your mercies, and testified against them, that you might bring them back to your law. Yet they acted proudly and did not heed your commandments, but sinned against your judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. And they shrugged their shoulders, stiffened their necks, and would not hear. Yet for many years you had patience with them, and testified against them by your spirit and your prophets, yet they would not listen. Therefore you gave them into the hand of the peoples of the lands. Nevertheless, in your great mercy, you did not utterly consume them nor forsake them. For you are God, gracious and merciful. Background notes. In verse 25, it's interesting that some skeptics of the Bible say that the Bible must be in error here, because from archaeological excavations in the Holy Land, there's not enough destruction seen at the time of the conquest, when the conquest supposedly took place. And yet we see here that the Bible teaches that we should not find a lot of destruction at the time of the conquest. The skeptics would say, well, if the Bible's true, how come we don't find more evidence of destruction in the so-called Late Bronze Age when Israel supposedly conquered the land, these skeptics say? Well, you know what the answer is? The answer is we should not expect to find destruction in the land at the time of the conquest. Because the Bible says here, verse 25, when they conquered the land, they did not destroy the cities. They took them over. Look at verse 25 once again. And they took strong cities and a rich land, and possessed houses full of all goods, cisterns already dug, vineyards, olive groves, and fruit trees in abundance. So they ate and were filled and grew fat, and so forth. They did not take and destroy these cities at that time. They took them over. The Bible teaches that only Jericho, Ai, and Hazor were burned and destroyed at the time of the conquest. All the other cities were taken over by Israel, and they actually possessed them and lived in them. So we should not expect in the archaeological excavations to find a lot of destruction at the time of the conquest. And that's exactly what is found in the excavations. Not a lot of destruction at the time of the conquest. Doctrinal point. God must discipline his children. God must discipline his children. As we trace the history of Israel in this prayer, we are amazed at the grace and mercy of God. But we also see his hand of discipline. Let's say his gracious discipline. Look at verse 27. Therefore you delivered them into the hand of their enemies who oppressed them. Look at verse 28. Therefore you left them in the hand of their enemies so that they had dominion over them. Look at verse 30. Yet they would not listen. Therefore you gave them into the hand of the peoples of the lands. God must discipline his children. Hebrews 12:6 says that the Lord disciplines those he loves and punishes everyone he accepts as a son. So if you're a Christian, you will experience God's discipline. But the discipline is always for our good. It's never God venting his wrath over us. Are you under the discipline of God right now? Maybe for some sin or for some reason? Well, submit to the hand of God and you will come to know the comfort and blessing of God. God must discipline his children. That brings us to our practical application for this section of the prayer, and it's this. We cannot escape God's discipline, but neither can we exhaust God's patience. We cannot escape God's discipline, but neither can we exhaust God's patience. We've seen from this passage that God does discipline his children, but we also see that he has unlimited patience. Look at verse 28. And many times you delivered them according to your mercies. Verse 30, yet for many years you had patience with them. Verse 31, nevertheless in your great mercy, you did not utterly consume them nor forsake them. For you are God, gracious and merciful. Aren't you glad that God's a patient God? Some of you here are parents. Some of you are going to be parents. Now, how patient are you with your children? Or how patient will you be with your children? We all have our limits, especially when you discipline for the same act of disobedience or rebellion over and over again. But God's patience with us is never exhausted. We've all seen the bumper sticker, "Be patient, God is not finished with me yet." Well, we really should add to that, "Be patient, God is not finished with me yet," because he's got a lot of patience. We cannot escape God's discipline, but neither can we exhaust God's patience. Let's read the last part of the prayer now, beginning in verse 32. Here we trace Israel's history from the time of the kings and the prophets through the captivity and right on to the time of Nehemiah. And at the end of the prayer, we'll see that the people make a written covenant that they will not forsake the Lord. Verse 32. Now therefore, our God, the great and mighty and awesome God who keeps covenant and mercy, do not let all the trouble seem small upon you that has come upon us, our kings and our princes, our priests and our prophets, our fathers, and on all your people, from the days of the kings of Assyria until this day. However, you are just in all that has befallen us, for you have dealt faithfully, but we have done wickedly. Neither our kings, nor our princes, our priests, nor our fathers have kept your law, nor heeded your commandments and your testimonies, with which you testified against them. For they have not served you in their kingdom, or in the many good things that you gave them, or in the large and rich land which you set before them. Nor did they turn from their wicked works. Here we are, servants today, and the land that you gave to our fathers to eat its fruit and its good things, here we are, servants in it, and it yields much increase to the kings you have set over us because of our sins. Also, they have dominion over our bodies and our cattle at their pleasure, and we are in great distress. And because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our leaders and our Levites and our priests seal it. A background note. In verse 32, we read here of the kings of Assyria and the trouble they brought to Israel, and yet how God was faithful always to keep his covenant with them. We read about several of these Assyrian kings in the Old Testament during the time of the kings and the prophets. One of the most well-known, of course, is Sennacherib, king of Assyria. He came down to attack Jerusalem in 701 BC during King Hezekiah's time. But God in his grace came in with a miracle to deliver Judah. Even though God was permitting Assyria to come in and oppress Israel, God delivered Judah here with a great miracle. You read about this in three places in the Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 37, 2 Kings 19, and 2 Chronicles 32. Let me just read to you about this great miracle in Isaiah 37 and verse 36. Then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses all dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. A tremendous miracle, certainly evidence of God's grace. This miracle, by the way, is documented extra-biblically in Sennacherib's prison in Chicago, down at the Oriental Institute. And if you could read cuneiform, you'd be able to read about this event right here. But it's certainly documented, not only in the Bible three times, but in Sennacherib's prison as well. But this is a tremendous miracle, evidence of God's grace, but Judah soon forgot God's gracious intervention and went back to their old ways. Doctrinal or teaching point. God does not break his promises. God does not break his promises. Let's look once again at verse 32. Now therefore our God, the great, the mighty, and awesome God, who keeps covenant and mercy. The word mercy here is sometimes translated love or loving kindness. It occurs about 250 times in the Old Testament, and it's really hard to translate into English in one word. That's why you have so many different translations. It's the word that's used in that recurring refrain of the great Thanksgiving Psalm, Psalm 136. Your love endures forever. Your mercy endures forever. Your loving kindness endures forever. So it's best translated into English by several words. It's really God's loyal, steadfast, faithful love. It's God's covenantal love. That is, he loves us in spite of what his people do. God does not break his promises. Do you think you can lose your salvation if the Lord has promised that no one shall pluck you out of his hand? John 10:28. Certainly you can't lose your salvation if you're really a Christian. God does not break his promises. Practical application. We don't have to be slaves on our own land. We don't have to be slaves on our own land. In verse 36 and verse 37, we read, we are servants or slaves today. We're slaves on our own land. And it says there that the kings that you have set over us, they have dominion over our bodies. What's that all about? Well, the Persians actually drafted Jews into the Persian armies. So they were like slaves on their own land. If they had followed the Lord and obeyed the Lord, this would never have been. They would never have gone into captivity. They would never be slaves on their own land, but they were slaves on their own land because of their disobedience. Well, God has given his people today a land. It's a land of spiritual blessing. It's a land of rest, as the book of Hebrews says. It's a land of peace and joy in spite of circumstances. But just as the Jews were under oppression by the surrounding enemies and unable to rest and enjoy their land, in fact, they were slaves on their own land, so many Christians today don't enjoy the land of blessing. They are slaves to the sin of anxiety about the future or about their security. They're slaves because of this sin of not enjoying God's blessings of the land. Instead, they're letting Satan rob them of their joy by raising doubts and questions. You don't have to be a slave on the land that God has given us. It's our land. He's given it to us. Let's not be slaves on our own land.